Good morning and welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, November 21st, 2022. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and here is our first story. Testing at contaminated Maquoketa site continues. This is an article by John Cruz out of Maquoketa, Iowa. State and federal officials are ramping up monitoring of a contaminated site in Maquoketa and the area surrounding it. In late October, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and Iowa Department of Natural Resources began installing monitoring wells in an area surrounding the Clinton engine site, an area that has previously been identified to be contaminating nearby groundwater with the chemical trilorethene, also known as TCE. The project is paid for by the EPA through its Targeted Brownfields Assessment Program. City, federal, and state officials could not provide an answer for how much it will cost. Shelley Nellison, environmental specialist with the Iowa DNR, said the wells will be used to determine how far the chemicals from the Clinton engine site have spread and to monitor how the plume of contamination will grow or move over time. It is part of a larger, targeted brownfields assessment of the site. At a minimum, she anticipates the testing will last 2 years. We want to make sure we know the extent of the plume, both vertically and horizontally, Nellison said. TCE was a chemical used at the Clinton engine site when it was the home of Clinton Machine Company, which constructed small engines in the Maquoketa from 1950 to the 1990s. Back then, the chemical was considered safe, but today it is considered carcinogenic by the EPA and has been found to negatively affect the liver, kidneys, immune system, and nervous system with prolonged exposure. Short-term exposure can harm developing fetuses. The TCE contamination of groundwater in Maquoketa can result in evaporating water vapors seeping into indoor spaces and contaminating the air. The presence of TCE vapors in the air at the Clinton Engines Museum, located directly on the Clinton Engines site, required the facility to begin running air exchangers at all times in order to keep the levels of TCE in the air below what is considered dangerous by the EPA. However, a sign is still posted on the museum's front door that warns pregnant women from entering. In 2020, the EPA conducted water, soil, and air testing of 30 homes and businesses surrounding the Clinton Engines Museum. While five of those properties did test positive for low concentrations of TCE, they were below what the EPA considers unsafe levels. Nellison said the new testing should not concern residents living around the Clinton engine site, and to date, dangerous levels of TCE have not been detected in any surrounding properties. There is no reason to be concerned, Nellison said. This testing is just to continue monitoring the site. Joshua Bolt, Maquoketa city manager, said the city continues to cooperate with the EPA and the Iowa DNR in monitoring the site to ensure the safety of the community. This has been a multi-decade effort, Bolt said. Everyone here knows the Clinton engine story. However, documents from the city and the Iowa DNR show that Maquoketa officials have been slow to conduct the testing of the site that was required by the state. On January 25, 2021, former Maquoketa City Manager Gerald Smith received a letter of noncompliance from the Iowa DNR for being overdue in conducting a required groundwater assessment as part of the city being involved in the state's land recycling program for the Clinton engine site. A February 23, 2021 letter from the city to the Iowa DNR stated that the installing of the wells and the first year of monitoring would cost the city $140,000, for which it was unable to secure funding through the EPA. In a letter to the city dated May 24, 2021, Iowa DNR officials remarked that the groundwater assessment continues to stall. Another letter from the Iowa DNR to the city dated August 24, 2021, states that the city was then working with the EPA Region 7 Brownfields Division to complete the groundwater assessment. When asked about the letters, Bolt, who was hired by the city in November 2021, said he was unaware of how the city handled the Clinton engine site prior to his arrival. "That was before my time," he said. While the installation of the monitoring wells is expected to be completed by late November, state officials are also seeking to find a new solution for mitigating the air contamination at the Clinton Engines Museum. Bonnie Mitchell, curator for the museum, said the facility's running of air exchangers at all times has proven both hard on the equipment and expensive to maintain. Our utility bills have tripled because of the air exchanges, Mitchell said. It's not sustainable. Mitchell said the museum is exploring developing a new solution to mitigate the levels of TCE that enter the building. Nelson said that could include the installation of a new air pressurization system inside the museum. Our next story is Schulzberg Athletic Center opens. This is by Kaylee Reese. After 4 years in business, a Schulzberg woman has opened a permanent home for her cheerleading, tumbling, and fitness classes. Katie Dental opened Badger Elite Athletics at 201 Wisconsin 11 next to Schulzberg Community Bank at the beginning of the month. She runs the business with her husband, Lauren, and is one of the cheerleading coaches. "I'm just so happy to have a home," she said, "to have a home that we know is steady and know there will be no last-minute changes is huge for us." Dental, who has been cheerleading her whole life, started Badger Elite Athletics as a cheerleading program 4 years ago when she didn't see any local school districts offering programs for kids. But classes moved to different locations multiple times over the years. The business mostly moved around Schulzberg, but classes did take place for a time in Platteville. "We started by renting any sort of gym space we could get our hands on, which in a rural area is very hard because of all the basketball programs, and volleyball programs, she said. "We made it work for 4 years, and somehow we were still competing and the girls were still winning things." She said the permanent location previously was used as a shop and storage space for Schulzberg Auto. Badger Elite Athletics currently has 65 cheerleaders in three teams with ages ranging from 5 to 17. With the permanent space, Dental also expanded to offer fitness classes for adults, a toddler music class, and tumbling classes for kids and teens. "I'm just excited to keep expanding and offering more extracurriculars for kids," she said. "I think that's really needed now. Kids today are often lost in the world of electronics with phones and laptops and iPads. I think it's really important to get little ones away from that and more into something that is really helping their all-around self. I'm excited to see where it takes us." Badger Elite Athletics can be found online at badgereliteathletics.com and facebook.com/badgereliteCheer. The business also can be reached via email at badgereliteCheer@gmail.com. Okay, our next article, Grant Program to Aid Arts Culture Organizations. This is by John Cruz. The City of Dubuque aims to provide additional financial relief to local arts and culture nonprofits still impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. Dubuque City Council members recently approved the Arts Operating Recovery Subgranting Program, which will use $435,000 in American Rescue Plan Act funds to award grants of up to $25,000 to local organizations to help them pay for ongoing operating costs. Jenny Peterson Brandt, Arts and Cultural Affairs Manager for the city, said the grants can be used to cover a variety of expenses, including marketing, salary support, utilities, fees for artists, and costs associated with health and safety supplies. She said the program is not restricted to organizations specifically working in the arts. Nonprofits with a broader range of programming, some of which include the arts, also can apply. The program aims to help local arts and culture groups still experiencing low revenues as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, either through low attendance at events or a lack of financial contributions to the arts. During that 2-year period of COVID, there was a huge loss of revenue for these organizations, Peterson Brandt said. This grant funding helps them to make up some of those costs and take some steps forward. Mickey Robinson, Operations and Marketing Manager for Bell Tower Theater in Dubuque, said attendance has remained low since the pandemic, forcing the organization to rely less on earned revenue and more on outside grant support. "We're not even close to back to pre-COVID levels," Robinson said. "We don't anticipate that it will go back to normal until at least 2024. So for now, this kind of funding is essential." Funding for the grants comes from a larger $500,000 National Endowment of the Arts Award that the city received in November 2021. While the vast majority of the funds will go toward the grant program, the city also will spend $15,000 creating a new program that supports individual arts-based projects. Peterson Brandt said that about $50,000 also has been committed to paying for a temporary city communications and grant administration assistant position, which was filled in August. While the funding was awarded to the city about a year ago, Peterson Brandt said it took time to determine how the funds would be distributed and to ensure the planned program aligned with federal guidelines. It was a long process, she said. It took some time to develop all of those materials. Peterson Brandt said grants will likely be awarded to local organizations by mid-February. Mayor Brad Kavanaugh expressed his support for the program during a recent Dubuque City Council meeting. I'm really glad to see us continue to use the ARPA funds that came our way in such a responsible way, he said. Oh, now let's do some news in brief. Dubuque woman sentenced to 60 days in jail for role in large fight involving slashing. A Dubuque woman has been sentenced to 60 days in jail, including for her role in a large fight in Dubuque, during which three women were slashed by a knife. Clayne C. Dominguez, 21, was recently given the sentence in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County after pleading guilty to a charge of assault, as well as for violating her probation. Dominguez was initially charged with participation in a riot, but pleaded guilty to the amended charge. She will also receive credit for time already served according to the sentencing order from Iowa District Court Judge Thomas Bitter. Dominguez was among five people who have been arrested in connection with a May 15th disturbance that originated at the restaurant First and Main on 101 Main Street. Jashona J. Vaughn, 20, of Dubuque, Cartesia L. Carpenter, 25, of Dubuque, Cartrice S. Carpenter, 31, of Dubuque, and Michael L. S. Hall, 22, of Davenport, Iowa, were all arrested on a charge of participation in a riot in connection with the incident, Vaughn. Vaughn has not yet entered a plea, though the other three have pleaded not guilty. Court documents state a fight inside spilled out on the street, and the Carpenters and Vaughn were cut by a woman wielding a knife. Traffic and surveillance video showed Catrice, Carpenter, and Vaughn exit the restaurant and immediately start fighting a group of three women that included Dominguez and Hall, documents state. City of Dubuque announces closures, service hours for Thanksgiving. City of Dubuque offices and facilities, including City Hall, will be closed on Thursday, November 24th and Friday, November 25th for Thanksgiving. Additionally, there will be no trash, yard waste, or curbside recycling collections on Thursday, according to a city press release. Those collections will be made on Saturday, November 26th instead. The Dubuque Metropolitan Area Solid Waste Agency landfill also will be closed Thursday. Jewel Transit will not operate on Thursday. Fixed route buses and minibuses will operate on their normal schedule and routes on Friday, except for the downtown shuttle, which will not operate. Parking meter, lot, and ramp violations will not be enforced Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. Carnegie Stout Public Library will be closed Thursday and Friday. For non-emergency issues, while city offices are closed, residents may call 563-589-4415. Police, one injured in Dubuque crash. Police said one person was injured Saturday in a two-vehicle crash after a driver failed to yield at a stop sign in Dubuque. Dina Antarinabat, 15, of Dubuque, was taken by Dubuque Fire Department officials to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center for treatment of suspected minor non-incapacitating injuries, according to a crash report. The crash occurred at about 10:15 a.m. on Saturday, November 19th, at the intersection of Hillcrest Road and Carter Road, which has stop signs in all directions. The report states that Antarinabat was traveling east on Hillcrest Road while a vehicle driven by Alos Shinko, 46, of Dubuque, was traveling south on Carter Road. Shinko stopped at the stop sign and then proceeded into the intersection. Antarinabat did not stop at the stop sign, and upon entering the intersection, her vehicle struck Shinko's vehicle. Both vehicles suffered heavy damage, according to the report. Antarinabat was cited with failure to obey a traffic control device and lack of a valid driver's license. Okay, the next story on opening weekend, sundown draws eager skiers and snowboarders. This is by Elizabeth Kelsey out of Asbury, Iowa. Brody Nix, 8, slipped on his skis on Sunday morning and surveyed the snowy slopes at Sundown Mountain Resort with satisfaction. "There's a jump over there, Lily," he said to his 14-year-old sister. "Come with me." "I bet I'll beat you to the bottom," Lily responded, using her ski poles to push off the hard-packed snow and follow her brother down the hill. The Dubuque siblings were among a crowd of skiers and snowboarders who visited the resort for its opening weekend. Sundown welcomed guests for the first time this season on Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday. Only its beginner ski area was open, with some terrain park features included. "It's a nice, easy start to the season," said mountain manager Chris McDonald. "We catered to the kids this weekend, and we picked a small run with one little lift." Although the Dubuque area did receive a trace of snow throughout the past week, the vast majority of Sundown snow this weekend was man-made. McDonald said resort officials were grateful for an extended stretch of below-freezing temperatures that allowed them to make snow and open earlier than usual. "It takes an awful lot of snow to get the bigger lifts running, but we were confident we could open this run ahead of schedule," he said. "We made a tremendous amount of snow in the last couple days." On a large snow pile at the top of the hill, 19-year-olds Zeus Fugate, Jack Swartzendruber, and Vinnie Bolin, all of Kelowna, Iowa, secured the straps of their snowboards after exiting the chairlift. The three have season passes to Sundown and were excited to learn the resort would open this weekend. "My mom told me this place was open, and I told these guys, 'We've got to come, right away,'" Swartzendruber said. "The snow's not bad for being mostly man-made." Brothers James and Austin Wadkins of Davenport, Iowa, and their friend Allison Borkowski of Bettendorf also made the drive. "It was the closest ski resort to us that was open today, and I got the day off work," said Austin Wadkins. "Anywhere I can get my skis down, no matter how much snow they have, I'm more than happy to go." James Wadkins says he views snowboarding as a way to both relax and test his skills. "It's all about the chance to challenge yourself," he said with a grin. "There's no rules." McDonald said Sundown will be closed from Monday to Thursday, November 21st to 24th, in hopes of reopening Friday, November 25th, with more runs, lifts, and terrain park features open. This will be dependent on weather, however, as high temperatures around 40 degrees are predicted for much of this week. Meanwhile, Chestnut Mountain Resort in Galena, Illinois, plans to open for the season from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Saturday, November 26th, according to the resort's website. Chestnut also intends to be open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Sunday, November 27th, before closing from November 28th to December 1st, with future hours to be determined. Okay, this next article is entitled "Former Manchester Mayor Earns Legacy Award." This is by Mike Putz from the Manchester Press. At the City of Manchester's Boards and Commissions open house November 9th, Mayor Connie Behnken announced a new award recognizing the lifetime of public service given to the city by former Mayor Milt Kramer. So it was only fitting the award went to the man it honors. Kramer is the first recipient of the Milt Kramer Leadership and Legacy Award. Behnken came up with the idea for the award, which will recognize anyone who gives a lifetime of service, either as an elected official or someone appointed to a board or commission. Kramer served in city government for 52 years, first as a council member, then the last 47 as mayor, retiring at the end of 2021. Behnken said it only made sense that Kramer's service be honored. "There are not very many people that get to serve one community for that many years," she said. "Manchester has always been very progressive. Milt is the best cheerleader for Manchester, the best ambassador. Everybody knows Milt. Nobody ever tells Milt no when he asks you to come serve, because you get so excited about the passion he has for the community. I thought individuals like that need to be recognized, and I couldn't think of a better name to put on the award than his." Behnken served as a city council member under Kramer before succeeding him as mayor. Serving with him, he was always a great mentor. "If you have a question, he has so much history and knowledge behind it. He always made you look at things from different perspectives. That helps from the way I'm trying to serve, but I'm amazed at all the connections he made over the years and all the things he did. His fingers were in a lot of things, and they were all good things that all kind of came together. He's been a great resource, and I'm forever grateful to him for that." Kramer said he was honored by the award. "It means an awful lot," he said. "I think if it shows that you want to get involved and want to work for the betterment of your community, people appreciate what you are doing. It's one way or another you'll be rewarded in the end." Kramer added that he encourages others to find ways to help their community. "There are a lot of things people can do," he said. "Just get involved. It's really easy to sit back and be negative. The last thing we need in our community and our nation is negativity. There are things you can do. Become involved and do your thing to represent and honor your city. Other award winners during the open house included Diane Monahan and Jack Young, Citizen of the Year, Richard Justice, Distinguished Service Award and Certificate of Appreciation for his work on the Board of Adjustment, Kathy Mersch, Certificate of Appreciation as Trustee of the Manchester Library Board, Dixie Willman, Certificate of Appreciation as Member of the Board of Adjustment. Next article, Manchester Fish Hatchery plays major role in state trout populations. Out of Manchester, Iowa, hundreds of yellow ovals offset the brown and green coloration of each female brown trout ready to spawn at Manchester Fish Hatchery. The splashes of color are signs that trout spawning season is in full swing. Brown trout spawning was completed a couple of weeks ago. Brood trout from the French Creek genetic lineage were collected from Spring Branch Creek in Delaware County. The fish are checked for ripeness and spawned streamside before being returned to the stream. All brown trout are stocked as 2-inch fingerlings. Anglers like these wild stream-raised fish. They are harder to catch than our put-and-take stocked fish, said Mike Stook, Iowa Department of Natural Resources Fisheries Supervisor for Interior Streams. Many of the public streams have lots of brown trout in them. Fewer and fewer brown trout fingerlings are raised and stocked as the number of self-sustaining, naturally reproducing brown trout populations increase throughout northeast Iowa. Brown trout, Iowa's only native trout, give up their eggs in late October and early November. Eggs are taken streamside from wild South Pine Creek brook trout, fertilized and taken back to Manchester Fish Hatchery to be raised and stocked as 2-inch fingerlings in June. As a part of DNR's brook trout restoration program, we're working to reestablish populations of Iowa wild brook trout in streams with suitable habitat and excellent water quality, said Stook. Rainbow trout, the backbone of Iowa's trout program, take up much of December and January. Roughly 750,000 eggs will be collected this season. Crews check for ripe female brood stock once per week. After a quick sedative bath to calm them, each big trout is held firmly over a plastic bowl as one of the workers rolls a hand down her belly to force out a stream of orange-golden eggs, up to 4,000 to 6,000 per fish. Mixed in quickly is the milk-white sperm from two males. Water is added to activate the eggs and sperm, allowing fertilization to occur. The ingredients are gently stirred with a turkey feather to avoid bruising the eggs. The fertilized eggs are poured into an incubator tray and slid into their place below a stream of 50 to 52 degree water until they hatch. Tiny sack fry hatch about 30 days after fertilization. Dark clouds of tiny fish grow in raceways at the hatchery. The fish are hand-fed for the first month, then trained to eat from automatic feeders. As the trout develop and grow, they are monitored and transferred to larger tanks, then raceways. The fingerlings will be kept at Manchester or transferred to Iowa's two other stations near Elkhater and Decorah to be raised for future stocking. In 13 to 15 months, they will be a half pound and ready to be stocked. Nearly 50 put-and-take streams throughout 9 northeast Iowa counties are stocked from April through October, and almost 20 community trout fishing locations are stocked through the cold weather months. We stock about 380,000 catchable rainbow trout from the hatcheries, said Stook. We also stock about 60,000 brook, brown, and rainbow trout fingerlings each year to grow in the streams. There's natural spawning, mostly brown trout and some brook trout, in more than 75 northeast Iowa streams, thanks to improved habitat and trout genetic, and an extended period of above-average annual rainfall. Most trout caught, though, are spawned under the eyes of hatchery workers at Manchester. Okay, I'm going to read from the opinion section. This first one is entitled Cynics Abound in Partisan Politics by Scott Reeder. Democracy is dying in this nation, and it's being killed by entrenched interests in both political parties. I can't say it any more bluntly than that. There are some things that I found encouraging in the recent midterm election. Trump Republicans in hotly contested congressional races took a shellacking. If I were to point to a singular character that epitomizes the rot within our political system, it would be the Donald. He's made unsubstantiated allegations of election fraud, shown contempt for the peaceful transition of power, and inspired an insurrection. And he has fellow Republicans quivering in their wingtips, fearful that he can torpedo their political careers. Regular readers of this column know that I'm conservative on economic issues and moderate to liberal on most other matters. And when I vote, I almost always split my ticket between both parties. When I first entered journalism, the conventional wisdom was for reporters to hide their political leanings. Readers aren't so naive as to believe journalists don't have their own political convictions. I've embraced transparency. That said, I strive to be fair in all my news stories. Sometimes, I'm delighted by a particular race. For example, I really enjoyed covering the contest for Illinois' 13th congressional district between Nikki Budzinski and Reagan Deering. Both women are bright, articulate, and have entered the realm of public affairs for the right reasons. After interviewing each of them, I found myself genuinely liking both. They had distinct philosophies, giving voters a clear choice. That's the way democracy is supposed to work. Unfortunately, in this nation, it seldom does. In fact, in any given election, less than 10% of races for the U.S. House are in play. In the other 90%, the candidate is either uncontested or facing only nominal opposition. For example, I live in Illinois' 15th congressional district. MAGA-loving Mary Miller will be my representative in Washington. She had only nominal opposition from a Quincy Democrat who no one believed could win. For state senator, I'll be represented by Steve McClure. He's a good guy, but he ran unopposed. In the old Soviet Union, they had elections where all of the candidates were unopposed. That wasn't, and isn't, democracy. My current state representative, Tim Butler, a Republican out of Springfield, also is a good guy who ran unopposed. But within a week of being reelected, he announced that he was resigning to become a lobbyist for the Illinois Railroad Association. So why run for a job that you're going to quit? Well, being a popular incumbent, his presence on the ballot dissuaded any Democrat from seeking the office. And now that he is leaving office, the Republican Party bosses, rather than the voters, get to pick his replacement. It's business as usual in Springfield. Both parties do it, but democracy is about having voters decide, not political insiders. The reason so few congressional and legislative districts are competitive is that instead of voters choosing their politicians, politicians are choosing their voters. Almost every state, Illinois included, is so effectively gerrymandered that for the vast majority of races, the outcome is preordained. But it gets worse. We now have a situation where politicians are not only picking their voters, but their opponents. We saw that this year in the governor's race, Governor J.B. Pritzker spent $30 million in the Republican primary to ensure that the GOP nominee, his opponent, was the weakest in the field. Republican Darren Bailey represents the far right of the party. He's a Trump acolyte, far out of step with most Illinois voters. Once the GOP nominated Bailey, Pritzker spent $110 million of his personal fortune to defeat him. It is worth noting that despite Pritzker essentially picking his opponent, having the advantage of incumbency, and outspending him by an 11-to-1 margin, he captured only 54% of the vote. A win is a win, but with those advantages, one would expect a better performance. Upon winning the election, our governor had this to say. To the fake patriots and their enablers, you don't love the United States if you're not willing to defend it against a man who would destroy it. So don't lecture us about norms or typical political practices. Against a party that nominates and endorses anti-Semites and racists and anti-immigrant zealots, appeasement and complacency do not work. While I don't entirely disagree with the statement, it wasn't one for Pritzker to make. After all, he spent $30 million to ensure a MAGA-loving fake patriot was the Republican nominee. It doesn't get any more cynical than that. You are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. Let's turn to sports now. We have a story out of the United States Hockey League, Spirited Effort Keys Military Appreciation Win, by Jim Leitner. Lucas St. Louis didn't have to look very far for inspiration Saturday night. It was emblazoned across the Dubuque Fighting Saints jerseys. St. Louis and James Reeder scored goals 98 seconds apart early in the third period to break a tie, and the Saints held on for a 5-4 victory over Muskegon at Dubuque Ice Arena. The Saints wore special military appreciation night jerseys that went up for auction following the win, which came one night after a tough 3-2 shootout loss to the Lumberjacks. Dubuque gained 3 of the possible 4 standings points during the weekend and pulled even with Muskegon for 4th place in the USHL's Eastern Conference standings despite playing 2 fewer games. It's always an honor to play in games like this because you're representing the people who make so many sacrifices for our country, St. Louis said. You look down and see the stars and stripes on your jersey, and it motivates you to give a little extra. St. Louis broke a 3-3 tie with a 5-on-3 power play goal 5 minutes 43 seconds into the final period. Max Burkholder, Ryan St. Louis, Mikey Burchell, and Lucas St. Louis moved the puck around the perimeter with Max Montes parked in front of the net before Lucas St. Louis wired a shot from the right circle into the high top left corner of the net behind goalie Connor Callahan for his first career USHL goal. It was really just aiming to get it on net, and somehow it went in perfectly, top left, Lucas St. Louis said. It happens. Reeder scored the eventual game winner at 7 minutes 21 seconds. Mikey Burchell hustled to avoid an icing, and Oliver Moberg won a battle before feeding Reeder for a shot that beat Callahan to the same spot as Lucas St. Louis's shot for his 4th of the season. Muskegon's a really good team, and we lost the last 2 to them, so it felt pretty good to get a lead on them and hold them off the last 10 to 15 minutes, Reeder said. Mogard made a perfect pass, and it came off my stick nice. It felt really good. Sean O'Donnell staked the Saints to a 1-0 lead just 2 minutes 50 seconds into the opening stanza with his first goal of the season. Riley Stewart jumped on a Muskegon turnover in the right corner and backhanded a pass toward the net front where O'Donnell deflected it past Callahan. The Saints doubled their lead during a 3-on-3 situation with 2 minutes 51 seconds remaining in the period. Theo Wahlberg pinched in from the point and wired a wrist shot past Callahan from between the circles after taking an Owen Michaels pass from below the goal line. Burchill earned a second assist. Ryan St. Louis stretched the lead to 3-0 at 1 minute and 42 seconds of the second period when he scored on a 5-minute major power play the Saints received when Jake Richards made head contact with Ryan St. Louis. Saints goalie Paxton Geisel stopped a Cody Kroll breakaway at one end, and Lucas St. Louis, Max Burkholder, Montes, and Junthorpe touched the puck before Ryan St. Louis hit a wide-open net from the right circle for his 6th goal of the season. But Muskegon scored 3 times in a span of 10 minutes 57 seconds later in the period to tie the game 3-3. David Heimovich scored the first goal, and Gavin McCarthy added the next 2. Ethan Whitcomb scored on the power play with 6 minutes 59 seconds remaining in regulation to eventually pull the Lumberjacks within 5-4. The first period was probably the best 20 minutes of hockey we've played all year, Saints coach Kirk McDonald said. We were outstanding. We owned the neutral zone. They just couldn't get anything through. We kind of stopped playing after we got that 3rd goal, but that's another learning experience. To the guys' credit, they came out and won the 3rd period. How many shots did we block that 3rd period? That's a credit to the group. The Saints went 2-for-3 on the power play and stopped 4 of Muskegon's 6 chances. The Lumberjacks finished with a 23-20 edge in the shots. We had a tough talk between the 2nd and 3rd periods, said Wahlberg, a defenseman from Stockholm, Sweden. That got us going a little bit. It was our military night, and we wanted to make sure we showed up. A night like this is a worldwide thing. It's an honor to play for the people who represent the military, and it was amazing to pay tribute to them. We worked as a team, and everyone worked his tail off. The 2nd period wasn't the greatest for us, but we worked together as a team in the 3rd, and that's the most important thing. Out of the National Football League, the title Fields Dinged in Defeat. Out of Atlanta, Marcus Mariota and the Atlanta Falcons are still under 500% and still in the thick of the NFC South race. Younghoe Koo's 53-yard field goal gave Atlanta the lead with less than 2 minutes to play, and the Falcons overcame another impressive game from Chicago's Justin Fields to beat the Bears 27-24 on Sunday. Fields ran for 85 yards with a touchdown despite suffering a left shoulder injury on the Bears' final possession. He was awaiting results on x-rays on the shoulder after the game and said, "I'm hurting a little bit." Fields said he was hurt on the first play of the Bears' possession following Koo's go-ahead field goal. Fields remained in the game. "I don't know what happened, to be honest with you," Fields said. "I just landed on it, I think. I was hurting, but it was the last drive of the game. I tried to be there for my teammates." Fields' pass for running back David Montgomery was intercepted by Falcons safety Jalen Hawkins with 1 minute 7 seconds remaining. A 26-yard run by rookie Tyler Allgeier allowed the Falcons, who rushed for 149 yards, to wind down the clock. Fields completed 14 of 21 passes for 153 yards with one touchdown and one interception. The Bears suffered their fourth consecutive loss. Chicago, just 3-8, has lost 6 of 7. Each quarterback had the most carries for his team. Mariota couldn't match Fields' dual-threat production, but he ran and threw for touchdowns for Atlanta, which pulled within one half game of NFC South leading Tampa Bay on the Buccaneers' bye week. "It's big for the team, and we've just got to keep rolling," Hawkins said. "Everything counts." Atlanta running back Cordarrelle Patterson, who played for the Bears for 2 years before signing with the Falcons in 2021, set the NFL record with his 9th career kickoff return for a touchdown. His 103-yard return in the second quarter broke a tie with Joshua Cribbs and Leon Washington for the mark. Patterson's lost fumble after a 19-yard run set up Fields' 4-yard scoring run that gave Chicago a 17-7 lead. Patterson atoned for the fumble with his record-breaking return. "Honestly, man, the fumble. The series before that was in my head the whole time, you know," Patterson said. "As a football player, you've got to move on the next play. I was happy when he kicked me in the ball because I had just had to go out and make a spark for my team. That's what I do." Mariota had 13 carries for 25 yards, including a 10-yard scoring run for a 24-17 lead in the third quarter. He threw for 131 yards, including a 2-yard scoring pass to Drake London. Koo's 40-yard field goal on the final play of the first half tied it at 17. Fields' ability to extend a 3rd-and-12 play by scrambling before passing to Equanimous St. Brown for a 14-yard gain set up Montgomery's 2-yard touchdown run to tie the game. According to NFL's Next Gen Stats, Fields ran 33.2 yards before completing the pass to St. Brown, the longest scramble on a third-down conversion in the league this season. Fields, an Atlanta area native, began his career at the University of Georgia before transferring to Ohio State. His homecoming came after running for a combined 325 yards in his last 2 games, setting a 2-game NFL record for quarterbacks. Fields said his goal is just keep getting better, take each day on its own, and keep working to control what you can control. All right, how about a little college basketball? The Cavs find reason to smile. This is from the Associated Press. Reese Beckman and his Virginia Cavaliers capped an emotional week by going on a late 13-point run to defeat Illinois and win the Continental Tire Main Event 70-61 on Sunday in Las Vegas. The number 16 Cavaliers, who are 4-0, trailed 58-56 with a 3.5 minute left when they broke away from number 19, Illinois, whose record is 4-1. Beekman scored 17 points and was the tournament MVP. Kehi Clark and Jaden Gardner each had 12 for Virginia. Jaden Epps had 14 points and Coleman Hawkins 10 for the Illini. The game was played exactly a week after Virginia football players Lavelle Davis Jr., Devin Chandler, and Deshaun Perry were fatally shot after a field trip to see a play in Washington. Former Virginia football player Christopher Darnell Jones Jr. faces 3 counts of second-degree murder and other charges. Virginia players wore shirts to honor those killed and locked arms in tribute before the game. Iowa State won 68 over UW-Milwaukee 53. At Ames, Iowa, Jared Holmes scored 19 points and Caleb Grill second. I'm sorry, Caleb Grill scored 11 points to lead Iowa State. The Cyclones, who are 3-0, never trailed, playing in their third home game of the season. Alex Kunk and reserve Robert Jones each scored 10 for the Cyclones. Kunk's three-pointer, 12 minutes and 42 seconds before halftime, gave the Cyclones an 18-8 lead. The Panthers rallied with an 11-6 spurt and got within 24-19 when Jalen Johnson made two foul shots. But Iowa State closed the half with a 13-7 outburst and led 37-26 at intermission. The Cyclones led by double figures throughout the second half. Despite struggling from beyond the three-point arc, shooting 6 for 28, Iowa State was 20 for 39 shooting inside the arc. B.J. Freeman scored 11 for Milwaukee, whose record is 2-2. Some results: Drake was 61 over Wyoming, 56. Number 5 Baylor was 80 over number 8 UCLA to 75. Number 1 North Carolina beat James Madison 80-64. Number 2 Gonzaga over number 4 Kentucky. It says 88. It does not say what Kentucky scored. Number 12 Indiana beat Miami, Ohio, 86-56. Number 20 Michigan beat Ohio 70-66. Number 24 Texas A&M beat Loyola Chicago 67-49. Number 25 UConn beat Delaware State 95-60. And Missouri won over Mississippi Valley State 83-62. Okay, we're going to read a few articles from the lifestyle section. This title is Shortage of Amoxicillin Leaves Patients Scrambling by Lisa Schenker out of Chicago. Katie Casas' 9-year-old son already had spent 2 feverish weeks suffering with the flu when his ear began to ache. Casas took him to his pediatrician last week, who diagnosed him with an ear infection and prescribed amoxicillin, a normally common antibiotic. The doctor sent the prescription to a nearby pharmacy. This time, however, the pharmacy didn't have the medication on hand. Like pharmacies across the country, it had run out, forcing Casas to go elsewhere. It's one thing to tell an adult to hold off, but the kids, when they're sick, you feel so awful for them, said Casas of Highland Park. This should be something very simple and readily available. This should not be something that's tough to come by. Amid a year of product shortages, the latest hard-to-find item is amoxicillin. A tight supply in the Chicago area has left some parents going from pharmacy to pharmacy looking for the medication and asking doctors to prescribe alternatives. Generally, it's possible to locate the medication at some pharmacies or to get an alternate prescription, doctors say, but it can be a hassle. Amoxicillin is often doctors' first choice of medication for ailments such as an ear infection, strep throat, and pneumonia, because of its effectiveness and few side effects. This is tough when your kid is sick and they need an antibiotic and you have to go to 2 or 3 pharmacies, or you have a delay while your doctor and pharmacy are figuring out an alternative, said Dr. Julie Holland, Vice President for Pediatric Primary Care for Chicagoland Children's Health Alliance. Parents don't want to be spending several hours calling the doctor's office or pharmacy and getting a different prescription when they have a sick child at home. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration listed the amoxicillin powder used to make a liquid version of the medication as being in short supply. The American Society of Health System Pharmacies has listed some amoxicillin capsules and tablets as being in short supply. Typically, adults take tablets and capsules, while children rely on the powder used to make an oral suspension, which is a liquid. Increased demand is listed as main reason behind the amoxicillin powder shortage on the FDA's website. It's possible that demand is high because of a nationwide surge of respiratory illnesses among kids, doctors say. In recent months, RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, and other respiratory sicknesses have spiked among children, filling children's hospitals in the Chicago area and elsewhere. Amoxicillin is not used to treat those respiratory viruses, but those viruses can sometimes lead to secondary infections such as ear infections and pneumonia, which do require amoxicillin or other antibiotics. What we frequently see is a child who gets a viral infection and then gets a secondary bacterial infection, Holland said. To deal with the shortage, the Chicagoland Children's Health Alliance has been working to ensure its pediatricians are aware of alternatives to amoxicillin, such as Augmentin, which is amoxicillin and a different antibiotic combined, and cephalosporins, which are different class of antibiotic, Collins said. The pharmacy at Rush University Medical Center has also taken steps to address the shortage after noticing that supplies of amoxicillin powder was dwindling about a week and a half ago, said Jessica Jacobson, clinical pharmacy specialist in the pediatric intensive care unit at the hospital. This medication is one we use quite frequently in our pediatric population, Jacobson said. We met and kind of came up with a plan to work and conserve our supply. That plan includes trying to limit the liquid version of amoxicillin to the hospital's pediatric patients while asking adult patients to take the capsules. The hospital pharmacy is using a lower concentration version of the liquid medication. That means a patient might have to swallow more of the medication to get the same amount of amoxicillin. The hospital also typically kept pre-filled syringes of amoxicillin in the emergency department to give doctors and nurses easier access to it, but has stopped doing that for now to conserve doses, Jacobson said. Dr. Nina Alfieri, an attending physician in advanced general pediatrics at Lurie Children's, said she hasn't seen the shortage affect her patients yet, but doctors are prepared. I don't want parents to ever think because of this shortage their kid is just going to sit there with bacterial infection and not get what they need, she said. She also encourages parents to make sure their children are up to date with their vaccinations, including against the flu and COVID-19. Though amoxicillin can't be used to treat flu or COVID-19, preventing those illnesses might help families to avoid the bacterial infections that can sometimes follow, she said. Casas, whose 9-year-old was sick this month, was able to find amoxicillin to treat his ear infection at a different pharmacy after the first one called her to say it and others in the same chain were out of stock. She feels lucky that she didn't have to wait long to get her son his medication. He's since started feeling better and has returned to school, she said. When they're needed, they're absolutely needed, she said of antibiotics. They're vital. Mayo Clinic Minute. Family Risk of Alzheimer's Disease by Jason Howland. Alzheimer's disease is a progressive disease that destroys memory and other important mental functions. Many people who have relatives with this disease worry that it might run in the family. Does having a family member with Alzheimer's disease increase your risk of developing it? If your family member has Alzheimer's disease, does that mean you'll get it too? There's a truly inherited form of the disease called familial Alzheimer's disease, early onset Alzheimer's disease, said Dr. Roland Peterson of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at Mayo. Peterson says people with this rare genetic form of Alzheimer's have a 50-50 chance of getting the disease, often at an early age, say in their 40s or 50s. The vast majority of the disease is called sporadic, but even in sporadic cases, there can be a familial tendency, he says. Sporadic cases tend to happen after age 65, so even if you don't have a known genetic link, but do have relatives with Alzheimer's disease, your risk could be double or triple that of the general population. In general, people 65 years and older, the risk of getting the disease is perhaps 10%, said Peterson. How can you reduce your risk? Dr. Peterson recommends moderate exercise, brain games, socialize, and eat a diet rich in fruit, vegetables, whole grains, and lean sources of protein. Genetic counseling after cancer diagnosis. This is a question to the Mayo Clinic. Dear Mayo Clinic, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer 2 months ago. My oncologist recommended I undergo genetic testing as part of the treatment plan. Why is this recommended since I already have cancer? What is the benefit of testing and what information will it provide? The answer from the Mayo Clinic. Genetic counseling can be an important part of a cancer journey. A genetic test looks for specific harmful gene changes called mutations or pathogenic variants that can cause someone to develop a genetic condition. Gene changes are like spelling errors within the body's instruction manual. Most genetic tests look for changes in a group of genes called a panel. However, testing might look for changes in a single gene where there is a known genetic mutation in your family. The most common genes typically thought of related to cancer risk are BRCA1 and BRCA2. These genes are associated with breast and ovarian cancer. It is known that changes in other genes can increase risk for these cancers as well. During a cancer journey, genetic testing can help your care team make recommendations for treatments for surgical procedures. For example, some cancers associated with genetic mutations respond better to certain types of chemotherapy treatments than others. Similarly, genetic testing can help patients make surgical decisions. For instance, a patient with breast cancer can use the information to determine between a lumpectomy or a mastectomy. Genetic testing can affect the management of cancer risk over time. The results of genetic testing can help your family members. Potentially your children, siblings, nieces, and nephews could have inherited the same gene mutation. For example, if you had a change in the BRCA gene and the testing showed this, your family members have a higher risk for breast and ovarian cancer. Knowing this information can be valuable to help them establish early screening schedules and make healthy decisions throughout their lives. It is important to know that most cancers are considered sporadic, meaning the cancer happens randomly or has environmental influences such as smoking and lung cancer. About 25% of cancers are considered familial. This is when multiple members of a family are affected by cancer. These family members have some shared genetic factors in combination with shared environmental factors that lead to the development of these cancers. About 10% of cancers are considered hereditary or have a single specific genetic component that can be tested and increase a person's risk for developing cancer. Genetic counseling and genetic testing can help determine which category your cancer falls into. Many other health conditions have a genetic link. Genetic testing can help you and your healthcare team understand if you have an increased risk for developing other conditions that are present in your family. If you are at risk, you may be able to take preventative measures to decrease your risk or undergo genetic testing to clarify your risk. While you can't change your genes, you can control some aspects of your environment, such as diet and physical activity level, as well as alcohol and tobacco use. That is why it's still so important to live a healthy life regardless of your personal and family genetic history. And I apologize, we usually do obituaries earlier. I did not see this obituary, so I'm going to go ahead and read that now. This is an obituary for John J. Matthews out of Livingston, Wisconsin. John J. Matthews, 99, of Livingston, died on Friday, November 18th, 2022. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to noon Tuesday, November 22nd, at St. Thomas Catholic Church in Montfort, where a mass of Christian burial will follow. Burial will be in Rock Church Cemetery in Livingston. Soman Larson Funeral Home of Montfort is assisting the family. There are also funeral services for Karen May Q, Hazel Green, Wisconsin. Visitation is 2:30 to 4, Saturday, December 3rd, at the Kingdom Hall of Jehovah's Witnesses in Dubuque. Service will be at 4 p.m. Saturday at the church. Thomas D. Felderman, Peosta, Iowa. Visitation is from 10 to 1:45 p.m. Tuesday, November 22nd, at St. John the Baptist Catholic Church, Peosta. Mass of Christian burial is at 2 p.m. Tuesday at the church. Darlene Irwin, Mount Carroll, Illinois. Visitation from 9 to 11 Tuesday, November 22nd, at the Hanover United Presbyterian Church. Service is 11 a.m. Tuesday at the church. Joan E. Jasper of Dyersville, Iowa. The service is 10:30 a.m. today at St. Francis Xavier Basilica, Dyersville. I'm sorry, that will be over by the time you hear this. Linda L. Clar, Dubuque. Visitation is 3 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, November 23rd, at the Bear Funeral Home. And the service is at 7 p.m. Wednesday at the funeral home. Rosemary Cruiser of Dubuque. Her visitation is from 3 to 8 p.m. today with a vigil service and sharing at 8 p.m. at the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road. And the Mass of Christian Burial is at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, November 23rd at Holy Trinity Catholic Church. Marty R. Miller, Hazel Green, Wisconsin. His visitation is from 9 to 11 Wednesday, November 23rd, at the Hodenschel Funeral Home and Cremation Services. That's in Cuba City. Service is at 11 a.m. Wednesday at the funeral home. Lloyd L. Mueller of Dubuque, his visitation is Wednesday. I'm sorry, his visitation is Monday, December 19th from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory. And the service is at 10:30 a.m. Monday at the funeral home. That was December 19th. Raymond M. Nyland, Hazel Green, Wisconsin. His visitation is today from 3 to 8 p.m. and 10 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, November 22nd, at the Rife Funeral Home, Peosta, Iowa. Service is at 11 a.m. Tuesday at the funeral home. Joseph Peavy of Dubuque. His celebration of life is 4 to 5:30 p.m. today at Grandview United Methodist Church. And Mary Pusateri of Dubuque. Her visitation is from 9 to 11 Wednesday, November 23rd, at St. Columbkill Catholic Church. Mass of Christian Burial is at 11 a.m. Wednesday at the church. And deaths elsewhere, Jason David Frank, who played the Green Power Ranger, Tommy Oliver, on the 1990s children's series Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, has died. He was 49. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I am your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.